From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Lots of headlines when it comes to COVID and the pandemic. UK government, Tim, this is positive. They're lifting the restrictions it imposed in England back in December when the Omicron variant caused a record spike in infections that now show signs of easing. So a peak coming down. That's good.
We're certainly seeing that here in New York City, but we should note that cases are still soaring elsewhere in Europe. France reporting a record of nearly 465,000 new infections. Italy and Germany also registered all-time highs. Switzerland decided to extend a work-from-home order to the end of February as cases surged. So different stories playing out, but we're learning more about how quickly, hopefully, Omicron can peak.
Exactly. Fingers crossed. Dr. David Kim is back with us, chief executive of Physician Enterprise over at Providence Health. The first known U.S. case of COVID-19 was confirmed in Washington State at Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett. That was back in early 2020, January of 2020. They're a massive hospital system. And Dr. Kim joins us on the phone in Irvine, California. Dr. Kim, so glad to have you back with Tim and myself here on Bloomberg. How are you and what are you seeing?
I'm doing well, and we are seeing a lot of what you are mentioning already, that COVID is, the Omicron is very infectious, and we're seeing it infect people much more easily than the previous variants, and we're seeing our hospitalizations rise as a result of that. Although the rate of the percentage of people that are winding up in the ICU is much lower relative to the previous surges with Omicron, and we're seeing milder disease.
Okay, so that's a lot of good news. What can you tell us, and forgive me, but I like to ask this to everybody who has an idea of what's going on in hospitals. Who is hospitalized right now, and are they vaccinated versus unvaccinated versus boosted? What can you tell us about who is actually getting very sick with COVID?
So there's different ways to answer that question. I would say who's getting hospitalized, we're seeing both vaccinated and unvaccinated people wind up in the hospital, and that is different with Omicron because we saw the Delta virus affected hospitalizations much less than people who are vaccinated. However, what we're seeing is that people who are unvaccinated being hospitalized are getting much sicker. So the percentage of people that are going to the ICU that do get very sick with Omicron tend to be people who have not been vaccinated or boosted.
Can you believe we're still talking about this and living this, Dr. Kim?
Yeah, a day is like a year these days. And, you know, depending on how you look at it, this is the third, fourth, or fifth surge we've had over the past 2 years. It has been a remarkable time in healthcare.
How do you balance normal healthcare with pandemic healthcare?
It's difficult, right? Not only are there constraints in the hospital because of the COVID patients, but there is a bit of a shift in the mindset of patients of when do they feel comfortable going to the hospital. And some of that has been positive in thinking through telehealth and the evolution of being able to get health care in new and novel ways. But some of it is concerning that people who need care aren't getting it. And we're there is a concern that once COVID is over, we're going to start seeing people who delayed care who are going to need care. We're going to see more significant consequences of that.
Yeah, it's so interesting that you say that. I mean, a year ago, Carol remembers this, I hadn't been to the dentist in a year because of COVID. And I finally got an appointment with a physician today for a checkup, but it was so difficult to get an appointment because all these healthcare workers, so many of them have gotten sick. So many of them are overworked. So it seems like the system is kind of being pulled from both ends here, Doctor.
Oh, yeah. The staffing issue, I would say, is almost as much of a concern as the COVID itself. That so much of our constraints these days are because people are getting sick and they can't work, or they're just tired, you know, and we see record numbers of people leaving healthcare as an employment option because of the past 2 years and the strains that COVID has put on the system and on the people who work in the system.
So what are the changes that need to be made? I mean, you're CEO of Physician Enterprise at Providence Health System. So you're making these decisions and you're looking closely at the data about people who are staying and people who are leaving. What needs to change in order to make sure that our healthcare workers in the U.S. do not get burned out?
I think that's the million-dollar or the billion-dollar question. We are really thinking through how do we keep hearts and minds engaged, and how do we keep people close to their initial calling of why they went into healthcare in the first place, and how we can keep healthcare from being a commoditized industry, but really be a place where people can fulfill the mission of why they chose a career to help others in their communities. And the more we can continue to bring that back into the why of why people came into healthcare and why they come to work every day, I think the more we can think about how we can sustain them through what is a very, very difficult time.
How do we do that, though? Like you said, you've got to figure it out. What are your thoughts on that? Is it a case of pay? Is it a case of respect? I think about how you said commoditized, you know, in terms of healthcare workers. I certainly don't think of that when I go to see somebody as like a commodity. I think about you're an expert. You had a lot of education. You know, you're taking care of our health.
Absolutely. We call those sacred encounters, and it is the reason why it's so fulfilling to be in healthcare, to have those moments of connection and relationship and intimacy almost with sharing your life and thinking about your health. How we do that, I think, is multiple fold. Some of it is through programmatic work around keeping people focused on the purpose and the mission of why. Some of it is around creating a work environment, whether that's compensation or cultural work or a sense of community that we can really get our arms around how to make people feel part of something and connected to the purpose of what we're trying to accomplish together.
Right.
And part of it is practical, getting people to work shifts that don't burn them out and so that they can find adequate time to rest, and equipping them with tools so that they can check out when they're home and not be thinking about work all the time.
All about wellness. That has been a big theme of this pandemic. Dr. Kim, David Kim, Chief Executive of Physician Enterprise at Providence Health, thank you so much. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
President Biden marking 1 year in office. We're going to hear from the president, I guess, in about an hour or so on that. In the meantime, in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Business Week, Bloomberg News White House reporter Jenny Leonard writes about how 1 year in, Tim, the president finds himself boxed in when it comes to China.
Jenny Leonard is White House reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us on the phone from Washington, D.C. Also joining us is Joel Weber, editor at Bloomberg Business Week. He joins us on the Access Line from Brooklyn. Joel, it's so interesting. At this point in the Trump administration, we'd probably be talking about a trade war, perhaps in the second year of the Trump administration. What exactly, though, is the policy that the Biden administration has toward China right now?
Well, that's the whole point of the story, my friend. So it's a really interesting moment because if I rewound the clock and we were at this moment, like you said, in the Trump administration, I think I had done multiple trade war covers already. And you know, here we are. Almost 1 year in, knocking on that door for the Biden administration. And I think, as Jenny's about to tell you, it looks pretty much like the same framework.
That's
right?
Exactly
right?
What I was getting at, Joel.
We haven't really even talked about trade forever. I just forgot all about it. So Jenny, remind us, where do things stand and what is the Biden administration's policies on trade with China especially look like?
Yeah, you got it right, Joel. It does look a lot like, you know, where Trump left office. And a lot of Democrats fear that that's sort of a weakness going into the midterm elections, because China, of course, is something that energizes voters. Of course, it takes a backseat to COVID and the economy right now. But Biden hasn't really, in the first year in office, put his own stamp on China policy. And even his allies say, hey, you know, I think we know what you're hinting at wanting to do, but we don't really know for sure, so why don't you tell us? The Biden administration has been meticulously reviewing sort of what they inherited, right? If you guys remember, the trade war sort of ended with the phase one deal. They inherited that. Those negotiations are still ongoing. The Chinese have fallen short on their commitments, which we knew going into this administration. And there's really no timeline for when those negotiations should result in any sort of outcome. So to sum it up, I would say, you know, they really need to hit the gas to show something in the midterms, because Democrats are getting a little antsy that Republicans sense a little weakness here.
You know, Jenny, what's the right China policy? I mean, I talked with the Cisco CEO, Chuck Robbins, earlier. China, we know, so important to global companies. But what's the right balance when it's safe to say world leaders, U.S. leaders, don't agree with Chinese social policies, but they also don't want to lose access to China's, you know, massive market potential that continues to be out there. So what is the right policy with China?
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head there on exactly what, you know, any government or any U.S. government is trying to balance, and where the different sort of voices come in when the different principles from agencies are discussing it, right? So you would have, you know, in thinking back to the Trump administration, you would, of course, have, you know, the more hawkish and dovish sides, you know, Treasury, USTR, Commerce, all these different entities that hear from different stakeholders. And I think the Biden administration is hearing exactly the same things, even as China has become more and more difficult to deal with, even as supposedly, you know, there's less interest in investing in China. We're still seeing how intertwined the economies are. And I think you've seen at least the Commerce Secretary be very vocal in this Biden administration saying decoupling is not an option. That is not something that is possible. That is not something that's desirable. If anything, we need to slow down China as much as we can, but we need to run faster. And so that's been the Biden administration's focus, you know, getting the American Rescue Plan passed, getting the infrastructure plan passed, and, you know, of course, now working on their third big plan, the Build Back Better plan, which is stalled. So there isn't really anything in the immediate term, and definitely nothing that they can show in the bilateral sense,
right,
where they say, hey, we're competing with China in a smarter way.
Jenny, we got to talk about the politics of this, because here we are. It's 2022, midterm elections coming up in November. We are expecting to hear from the president to really give a speech about his first year in office at 4 o'clock today, Wall Street time. How are Republicans, though, using the president's policy toward China, the administration's policy toward China, as a way to criticize him?
So I think Republicans are definitely, you know, seizing the moment that Biden, for now, and they might prove us wrong, you know, in 2 months, but for now, Biden has adopted and kept in place Trump's policies, which, of course, you remember the Republican Congress has pushed him there. There's a lot of, you know, China hawks in Congress that are maybe gearing up for presidential runs themselves in 2024, that are running for re-election to their Senate seats or House seats in 2022. So they feel emboldened knowing that the Biden administration is sort of boxed in, leaving in place the policies that, you know, they sort of pushed the Trump administration to go for. And they are seeing, you know, this boxed in situation for Biden too, that I think they're sort of relishing a little bit, that Biden is, you know, maybe unable to do much on China that could hurt the U.S. economy even more when you think about tariffs, right? So currently we have tariffs in place. Everyone knows that, you know, taking off tariffs will probably leave Biden even more vulnerable to criticism from Republicans. But adding more tariffs to it, if that is your enforcement tool, is maybe not something they want to go down. It's not really a path they want to, you know, go down. And so Republicans see this current reality for Biden and, you know, are probably enjoying watching him sort of figure out his way out of this box.
Okay. we spent a lot of time learning a cast of characters in the Trump administration who would love to tip their cards and talk about how negotiations were going. We have heard nothing about who's leading the charge on the American side in the Biden administration. Who are the players, real quick, Jenny?
Yeah, certainly a different cast of characters, and they're way less likely to tell us how it's going. It's the chief negotiator here is Catherine Tai, the U.S. Trade Representative. She's been in touch with the Chinese only twice in the first year in office. Her deputy, Sarah Bianchi, who handles China issues, has been in touch with the Chinese also a couple times, although the agency decided not to disclose that. So interesting there. And then, you know, of course,
right.
Treasury Secretary Yellen and Commerce Secretary are also key players here.
Yeah, a lot of top names there in the administration. Hey, thanks so much. Bloomberg News White House reporter Jenny Leonard from D.C., of course, along with Bloomberg Businessweek editor Jill Weber from Brooklyn. That story in the upcoming issue of Bloomberg Businessweek magazine. It's online on the Bloomberg. That magazine out later this week.
What could you do if your data was working for you and not against you? With Bloomberg delivering enterprise data directly to your systems, you get easy access to the details you want, optimized for higher-level analysis, and financial data experts committed to helping you maximize your every move. Our data is made for more, so you can show the world what you're made of. Visit Bloomberg.com/enterprise data to learn more.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So we had a bunch of big banks report over the last week. And Tim, we had what, Morgan and B of A today coming out with numbers.
Yeah, we've already heard from Goldman Sachs and we've heard from JP Morgan Chase. We're also starting to hear from the regional banks as well.
Right. And I know that's something that's certainly always on the radar of our next guest. Anton Schutz is back with us. He's president and chief investment officer at Mendon Capital Advisors on the phone in Florida. Anton, good to have you here. Happy New Year. How are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. How about yourself?
Doing okay. You know, taking one day at a time, as we do. Good to hear, though, and kind of get into earnings, because I really love when we start to hear, certainly from the financials and from leaders overall. The big banks, how do you see it? Not only the numbers today, but the numbers we got last week. How are the banks doing? I mean, compensation is one of those things, increased costs showing up big time.
Well, it's compensation, it's technology, and, you know, it's a real, you know, difference in strategy between a number of these companies. You know, if you think about, you know, JP Morgan investing $12 billion in financial technology, right? I mean, that's more than all the disruptors combined, probably, right? Investing in new innovation and research. I mean, they certainly can win the game, but, you know, it comes at a cost. It's amazing they can earn the amount of money they earned while spending $12 billion.
Yeah. So true. Anton, what does that look like? Because when we talk to fintech companies, for example, you know, I talked to Chris Britt, the CEO of Chime yesterday. It's a $25 billion fintech. It doesn't call itself a bank, though it offers banking services. It's just got a massive, massive private market valuation. Is the idea for JP Morgan to invest in products like that? Because help me understand what these fintech investments are.
Well, I mean, they're obviously trying to make themselves more efficient. They're trying to improve their delivery process. They're trying to improve their ability to provide compliance, which is, you know, it's very expensive. And if you look at the core processors, the Fiservs, the Jack Henrys, the FISs, those are very expensive cores. And, you know, all the banks use them. And at the end of the day, if you can find a way to deliver all of your products that even exist to your customers, right, cheaper, then you get to eliminate some of those very expensive human capital costs that are there today. You can't get people to come to work anyway. And obviously, if you can get people to come to work, you've got to pay them more. So part of the money spent on the innovation is not just in new products, really. It's in how do you deliver those products, and it's how you provide compliance for that delivery. And I think that, you know, we'll learn a lot more about that compliance as the regulators get more involved in unregulated, you know, fintechs, right? The banks are very regulated. We just saw SoFi this morning. It's going to become a lot more regulated.
Yeah.
Now, you know, it's got approval to become a bank. And one of the first things regulators said, well, wait a second, you know, on the crypto side, you guys have got to back off a bit. You know, we've got to get to understand you better as a bank.
Anton, in terms of the financial space, and you've been investing in these types of names for a long time, you like often the regional space. But is fintech and the newer upstarts starting to get, you know, garner any more of your attention or potentially some of your thoughts about, well, you know what, we should be putting and committing money there?
Well, I really like banks that have fintech embedded in them. So you talk about these private market valuations, and obviously some of the public valuations, and a lot of those companies don't earn money. And I'm a traditional value investor. Of course, I'm always looking for, you know, what creates value. And if I can find banks that have fintech embedded in them or managements that are leaning forward that are going to create a better mousetrap, you know, for instance, in New York, a New York community that's really embraced, you know, fintech and blockchain technology, or a Signature Bank also headquartered in New York that's done a lot of it, or Silvergate or Triumph, or we've talked about Live Oak Bank before. You know, these banks all have fintech embedded in them. They're all using it to deliver. They're investing in it. And they're part of the future. And I think as we start looking at that stable coins and who's going to have that ability to really get approval from the regulators, it's going to be the banking system.
Is it going to be more regional banks or the big banks?
I think the big banks will eventually get
involved. Because it does seem like the regional banks are leading in that right now.
They are. It's you know, part of that's the decision tree, right? I mean, J.P. Morgan's a really large organization. They've literally, I think, said they invested 100 fintechs last year. Parsing them, getting them, you know, to the market, getting them distributed through that very large organization, it's harder to do that. If you're a smaller entity, it's a lot faster to bring something to market, and you can, you know, test things out with some customers and get it going without a very large, you know, bureaucracy, to say the least. And obviously, some of those banks are better at getting things to market, but it's a lot easier if you're a multi-billion-dollar bank rather than a multi-trillion-dollar bank.
Anton, what do you think the banking environment's going to be like for some of the names that you hold on to, whether it's a Live Oak, whether it's an Equity Bank shares, First Bank shares? I mean, it's going to be a better environment because of a higher rates that we're starting to see certainly come through the system. How do you see it?
Well, higher rates, everybody always talks about how great those are for
banks.
And yes, absolutely, a good yield curve, higher short-term interest rates are good for almost all banks. And you've got to raise rates quite a bit before you start creating credit issues out there, which is obviously the other side of that. But I think the thing that's really important here is there was so much stimulus put into their customers' hands that loan growth really didn't exist a ton other than some of those faster-growing markets like Tennessee or Texas or Florida nationally. So now you've got the loan growth coming back, right? You've seen some good loan growth numbers out there across the guys that have reported, and I think that's really critical. So, yeah, higher rates matter and will matter, and they're not all in the estimates yet. But loan growth is really what, you know, what drives earnings here.
Right. All right, so we'll be watching out for that. Anton, thank you so much. We really always appreciate the perspective you have and the informed perspective. Anton Schutz, President and Chief Investment Officer at Mendon Capital Advisors, on the phone in Florida. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
I'm driving in my car.
How about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive home.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
You drive me crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
You drive me crazy.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
We are driving to the close, just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. And Tim, as Charlie mentioned, we are near our lows of the session on those major equity averages. I'm curious what our next guest has to say, because he runs a fund, the Rational Dynamic Brands Fund. We've talked with him before, and over the last 3 years, it's up on average 22% annually, putting that fund in the 89th percentile, according to Bloomberg data. So it's been an outperformer.
We're talking about Eric Clark, Portfolio Manager at Rational Dynamic Brands Fund. He joins us now on the phone once again from San Diego. Eric, how are you?
I'm good, Tim and Carol. How are you?
We're doing well. Look, the story today, obviously, is about what's happening on the NASDAQ composite, down in correction territory, more than 10% below its peak from November 19th of last year. How are you reading into this?
You know, I think there's that short-term noise surrounding interest rates and the Fed and how aggressive they're going to be with rate increases, as well as withdrawing some accommodation and maybe even outright selling of bonds. You know, I have my own personal view that the Fed is not willing to tank the markets and the economy just to try to reduce inflation. So I think they're more trying to talk it down But that has an effect on high multiple stocks, and it's been a very popular part of the market. And so I just see that de-risking happening until there's some realization that the Fed's probably not going to be as aggressive, and people are much more wrong-footed about where their positionings are. But it's certainly been a painful, you know, couple of months for sure for high beta stocks.
All right. So what does it mean, Eric, for some of the names in your portfolio? We've often talked about investments that you've got in an Alphabet, a Microsoft, a Netflix, an Apple, an Amazon, and more. A lot of those well-known tech names, that have certainly provided support to the equity markets over the last couple of years. You still like them?
I do. I absolutely do. I mean, you know, we have certainly shifted up the portfolio in quality, you know, big profits, lots of free cash flow, great balance sheets, the ability to buy back stock, but, you know, add to the dividend growth, those kind of businesses, which frankly have kind of underperformed over the last couple of years. It wasn't that long ago when we had the companies without profits and lots of growth were really what drove the bus. Mm-hmm. And now, you know, we're more focused on the stable, predictable growers with great balance sheets that have good pricing power and have a lot of brand love. So it's a very highly recognizable portfolio currently.
So help me out. Microsoft up 41% in 2020. It was up 51% last year. Oh, in 2019, it was up 55%. Speaking of healthy balance sheets, it has a lot on its balance sheet, or a little bit less, as it buys Activision. Do you want to change your holdings at all because of this, or do you like Microsoft even more and want to add to the position?
Well, I would love to add probably a little bit lower than where it is today, because it really hasn't had a real deep sell-off yet. I did find the potential acquisition of Activision pretty interesting, and using Activision's cash as part of that. So
interesting, I mean, good, interesting, are, interesting, good, interesting.
Good,
I'm scratching
good.
My head. Okay.
Yeah, no, I think I like that just moves further into gaming and also with this, the potential of what the metaverse could look like at some point. So, I mean, that IP and staff and engineers, they're hard to come by. So in some ways they're buying the infrastructure to keep building their video business, you know, their gaming business and whatever the metaverse looks like over time.
Okay, well, speaking of the metaverse, we're not there yet when it comes to Netflix, but that company reporting earnings after the bell tomorrow, increasingly getting into games. What are you looking for from Netflix?
You know, last quarter, they told us that they were going to be spending aggressively on content. So anybody that's surprised that free cash flow is down when they report tomorrow, you just didn't pay attention to last quarter. Bigger picture, though, we still think, you know, let's say they have 220 million subscribers around the world. We think they have 500 million plus. They got 29 billion in revenue now. That's going to equate to maybe 100 billion in revenue. So, I mean, I think this is the brand when people around the world start to search for content. It used to be the cable channel that you opened up. Now I think it's Netflix first. And then if you can't find what you want, you go other places. So it's still the dominant brand. And, you know, if the market, you know, right now the market's in kind of sell everything mode. So if the response is lower, I'm going to buy more for sure.
What name have you most recently been adding to?
Well, we have been adding, because of the market volatility, we've been adding some stable, predictable type of, you know, defensive. So we added pretty aggressively, you know, NextEra Energy. Not everybody knows what NextEra Energy is. It's the old Florida Power and Light, but so it's a public utility, but they also have a renewable energy business that's high growth. And so that you know, they have, it's a public utility with great stable revenues, great dividend growth. It's, you know, increased their dividends 25 consecutive years plus. So that and maybe a United Health. I thought the quarter was great, reported this morning. The stock, you know, has been selling off ever since the print. But again, I think we're more in the sell everything mode, and those kind of stable, predictable businesses I really like in this, you know, in this next, you know, 6 month period, along with some of the more higher beta stuff. So definitely the defense, and even a Sherwin-Williams, I still really like the housing trade, particularly as interest rates get to the top end of the range.
Hey, Eric, what about Amazon? Just in the last minute or so that we have with you, the company's down more than 6% year to date. It was only higher in 2021 by 2.3%. What's going on with Amazon?
Well, it's a big yawn, hasn't it? I mean, it's been a kind of a two-year yawn after a really strong 2000. But, you know, they have had so many spending cycles that lead to higher revenue growth and higher free cash flow periods. So, you know, you have to accumulate the stock when they're in high spend mode to get the benefit of the ramp when the revenue comes back and the free cash flow goes back. So whether it's this quarter or next, you're going to see all of a sudden the free cash flow vault back up and people are going to be surprised and the stock's going to catch a bid like it has for the last 25 years.
Just quickly, 20 seconds, does Amazon become a dividend company at some point, a dividend payer, or they don't need to?
I don't think it's part of their philosophy and their mentality. There's a lot of those that do, but I just don't see Amazon becoming that.
All right, we're going to leave it on that note. Always love talking with you. You get into the specifics. You get into the names that are in your portfolio and explain why. So thank you so much for that. Eric Clark, he's portfolio manager at Rational Dynamic Brands Fund, joining us on the phone from San Diego. As we mentioned, his stock has been, his fund has been an outperformer, up on average 22% annually, and we've got it in the 89th percentile, according to Bloomberg.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV+.